You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Keely Boltina.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we go inside the new Zen Den for students to take mental health breaks at Appleton East High School.
First, in his remarks from the White House yesterday morning, President Trump said capturing or killing Islamic State leader Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi was his top national security priority.
The president announced al-Baghdadi killed himself and three of his children during a raid by U.S. forces in northwestern Syria on Saturday.
Under his control, ISIS took thousands of lives across Syria and Iraq, often in large suicide bombings or mass executions. At the peak of his rule, ISIS controlled a chunk of territory about the size of Britain. By 2017, it had lost almost all of that land.
Here's some of what President Trump had to say about al-Baghdadi's death.
A brutal killer, one who has caused so much hardship and death, has violently been eliminated. He will never again harm another innocent man, woman, or child. He died like a dog. He died like a coward. The world is now a much safer place.
So, with al-Baghdadi gone, what happens now with ISIS?
Jessica Stern is a research professor at Boston University's Pardee School of Global Studies and the co-author of ISIS, The State of Terror. She also wrote a piece in the New York Times about what al-Baghdadi's death means for the fight against terrorism. Jessica, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
How significant is the death of Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi?
I think it's quite significant. I think it's important. I think he was symbolically extremely important and attractive to his followers. I don't think it's important militarily, but it is extremely important symbolically.
Symbolically, but do we have the sense that he was logistically making important decisions running the show for ISIS still at this point?
That's not clear. What I think is really a really important question is the extent to which he was involved with the so-called wilayat or provinces. And there, it looks like he probably was not actively involved himself, but nonetheless, the image of the so-called caliph, I think, is important for attracting groups that might otherwise have aligned with, for example, al-Qaeda. I think there is his presence is important for that reason. He's a descendant of, or claims to be a descendant of Muhammad, the prophet Muhammad, and that seems to be a part of his appeal. Also, he is an Islamic scholar. Obviously, many Muslims do not recognize the version of Islam that he claims to practice and that he promotes, but the fact that he actually is trained as a scholar, it makes him different from many alternatives. That doesn't mean that the group will disappear in any way. I don't believe that, but I nonetheless think that he played an important role.
A big turning point in the development of ISIS was the break with al-Qaeda. What led to that? I've seen people argue it was a personality difference between the leaders of the two groups or a tactical difference with ISIS saying, we can be a nation, we can claim territory where al-Qaeda didn't want to do that. What did you see leading to that break?
Well, there is a difference in that Baghdadi did declare the caliphate here and now, and for al-Qaeda, that was a long-term dream. It wasn't something they were prepared to do immediately. There's also a difference in the level of brutality. Al-Qaeda admonished both Zarqawi, who was the predecessor to Baghdadi. He was the leader of al-Qaeda in Iraq. He was also extremely brutal, and Baghdadi himself, extremely brutal, a level of brutality that we really haven't seen before. But I think the notion that it was more about control and competition for control is probably, if anything, even more important than any ideological differences. was more who gets to run the more important group and where.
What led a nation or a territory to be at risk of infiltration of the creation of a group like ISIS in its territory, whether it's original spaces like Syria or Iraq or other countries they've branched out into?
Well, there are a lot of risk factors that political scientists have identified, and they include low opportunity costs for young men's time in the sense that they either are unemployed or underemployed at the level of the nation, poor governance, sectarian tensions, and especially sectarian tensions that lead to conflict or civil war. Those are some of the risk factors. And unfortunately, we see those risk factors present in a number of countries in the Middle East and North Africa and South Asia. And we see it in, obviously, Afghanistan. We see it in Nigeria. We see very serious sectarian tensions. We see it in Somalia. We see it in Libya. And ISIS was able to attract so-called, well, groups, but also claimed provinces in these countries.
We're talking to Jessica Stern from Boston University, co-author of ISIS, The State of Terror, looking at the death of ISIS leader Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi in a U.S. attack a couple days ago. Are there lessons to be learned from the events over this weekend, the death of this leader of ISIS, that the U.S. could take combating ISIS or whatever ISIS morphs into next?
Well, I don't really see this as a battle against ISIS per se. I think it's a very long-term battle against the jihadi movement. And some of my colleagues really pay attention to, for example, the split between al-Qaeda and ISIS that you mentioned. I don't see it as important as the long-term jihadi movement that we are fighting, because if you look at the history of jihadi terrorism, it's very, very common that these groups split off. There are factions that split off. They change their names. They change their allegiances. They merge with groups that were formerly their arch enemies, and so on. So one of my colleagues has been predicting for quite some time, this is Bruce Hoffman, that al-Qaeda and ISIS would eventually merge. That was a position that was hard to defend for a while there when the two groups were so actively fighting. But right now, it does look like a real possibility that fighters from ISIS might switch allegiances. Some of them might switch allegiances and join with HTS or the group that is sometimes known as al-Qaeda in Syria.
From what you were just saying, though, it sounds like we should be looking at more than just a tactical battle against this group or that group, but a more fundamental effort against a particular ideology and a terrorist expression of that ideology. How do you do that?
That's a big question. Nobody's really figured it out yet. I mean, we've tried so-called counter-narratives. So the government has gotten involved in disseminating counter-narratives to show that ISIS was not at all the five-star jihad that it was advertising itself as, but was actually incredibly brutal. It didn't work very well. I think that the ideology will eventually fade in attractiveness. It's right now, it's an attractive ideology for those who aim to change the status quo. It will change over time. I mean, it's a fundamentalist ideology to turn the clock back to a so-called the Salafi aim to turn the clock back to a simpler golden era. And it's in many ways similar to other fundamentalist ideologies. The aim is to turn the clock back to an imaginary time when the world was simpler and better.
Is there a way that through U.S. foreign policy we can help lower the risk factors in countries around the world where young, I guess mostly young men, are attracted to this kind of extremist ideology?
Well, to the extent that we can help reduce sectarian tensions, that's something that we have been trying to do for a long time in Iraq. To the extent we can do that, to the extent that we can encourage not so much electoral democracy, but liberal institutions that protect religious minorities, religious or other minorities, then yes, perhaps there is a role we can play. I think Americans are beginning to lose tolerance, to the extent they ever had it, for trying to intervene in this way. I think Americans are feeling extremely discouraged about our capacity to resolve conflicts far away. We try, and we seem to get stuck in a long-term conflict and have trouble getting out without making things worse.
In our last few moments, what are you watching for next?
I guess I really am going to be curious how much we see a kind of merger and perhaps new factions splitting off of what remains of ISIS. That's something that I will be watching closely.
Thank you so much for joining us today. I appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
Jessica Stern is a research professor at Boston University's Pardee School of Global Studies and co-author of ISIS, The State of Terror. We talked with her about her New York Times piece on the death of ISIS leader Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi and what it means for the broader fight against global terrorism.
Coming up, we talked to the principal of Appleton East High School about the school's new Zen Den mental health space. This is Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Keeley Boltina.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll talk to two members of the State Assembly's Agricultural Committee about Wisconsin's farming economy and the legislation they're working on to help out small farms.
Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with the history of bookmobiles.
Bookmobiles have long dotted Wisconsin's roadways and parking lots. The state has a history of bringing books and movies to the people living anywhere from the Wisconsin Dells to Green Bay. The historic Door County Bookmobile is one of the many items included in the Wisconsin 101 Project, which tells the state's history through objects. Jane Jensky went to learn more about the role that bookmobiles play in our communities.
On a hot summer day on the north side of Madison, families shuffle in and out of the Dream Bus. It's a bookmobile with bright cartoons painted on the outside.
This is a public library on wheels. So we have books, we have DVDs, we have CDs, we have audiobooks.
That's Amy Winkleman, a librarian on the Dream Bus.
The idea is to bring library service to people that may otherwise, for whatever reason, have trouble getting to a library branch.
Yeah, so we filled the top with his information for his card in there.
This is a big outreach project. We want everyone to know that we want them to be able to use that public library service.
The bus can hold around 2,500 books on its specially tilted shelves so they don't fall off. The librarians are sure to stock the appropriate books for each of the stops in Madison and Sun Prairie. Readers can find anything from foreign language materials to children's books. Plus, the librarians take special requests.
It's a really fun way to get people excited about library service.
The Dream Bus is one of the many bookmobiles in Wisconsin. The state has a rich history of bookmobiles serving communities, especially in rural places like Door County. The Door County Bookmobile was a traveling public library that brought an array of books to the peninsula. In the 1950s, only the area's wealthy families had large book collections, or those living near larger cities like Sturgeon Bay had access to books. Students in rural schools were underperforming in reading and writing. Farmers worked all day at the expense of reading time. Many schoolhouses in Door County only had about 15 books on their shelves. Michaela Kraft is an intern at the Egg Harbor Historical Society. She has been researching the function of the bookmobile and its legacy for Door County today.
So the bookmobile actually was founded out of a need here in Door County, especially for rural readers.
The state funded the bookmobile in Door County and Kewaunee County in the 1950s. It was then up to the residents to decide if they wanted to continue funding it with tax dollars.
And then in 1952, they voted Kewaunee and Door County, and only Door County kept the bookmobile service.
This led to increased literacy scores for children living in the area.
It was actually instrumental in a lot of the older generation now loving reading.
The bookmobile would travel all over the peninsula. It stopped at churches, schoolhouses, and street corners. For many children and adults, it was a chance to learn anything from new languages to farming to home improvement tips.
The school children would look forward to the bookmobile because it would come once a week and they could choose anything.
The bookmobile brought excitement and curiosity to Door County. It opened the world to small communities who otherwise wouldn't know what was going on beyond the peninsula.
I think before the bookmobile, a lot of children especially weren't even aware of print culture or the opportunities that they could discover outside of their county because they were so exceedingly rural, and there were a lot of immigrants who a lot of times wouldn't even speak English outside the home even, so they would only have that experience of the outside world through reading.
In addition to increased literacy scores and eye-opening experiences for isolated residents, it also provided a sense of interconnectedness amongst the scattered communities in Door County, much like the bookmobiles continue to do today.
That story about bookmobiles came from Jane Jensky, a UW-Madison student working on an internship for Wisconsin Life and Wisconsin 101, which tells the history of the state through objects. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Now, students at Appleton East High School have a new dedicated mental health space this year.
It's called the Zen Den, and its construction followed some troubling research about attempted suicides by high school students in the Fox Cities region.
Matt Mino is principal of Appleton East High School. Matt, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much, Keely.
Let's start. Describe your school's Zen Den. What does it look like?
So, I mean, it's not too large, but it's just the right size. And it was a place where we had several secretaries' desks and location a while back. But it has got a lot of great things for mindfulness, from a plant wall to amazing like green space where students can come just be and do some mindfulness coloring and other things like that. We also have a wall projector with different images that flood the area, and just dim lighting, strategic coloring to be a place of mindfulness.
Yeah, and some pale blue walls and even like comfy seats, rug. It doesn't look too much like a regular room in a school.
Right. And I think that's the beautiful thing is as schools are progressing through history, we have to continuously try to innovate and try new ideas to make spaces that really fit our kids.
So how have students been taking advantage of this? It's new this year.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so right now it is per counselor base. So a student would come down and per the counselor recommendation would say, hey, just take a breath and use the space for about 10 minutes. And after that 10 minutes was up, then we check in with them. We actually have those little buzzers from like you would see in a restaurant that would, you know, go off in that period of time. Another person would check in with them and say, hey, where are you at right now? Do you need a little bit more time or do you need to see a counselor or a social worker? And then if they're set to go, they'd head back to class.
Is this to replace seeing a school counselor? Is it in conjunction with those services? How does that work?
It's not to replace. It is another option, another resource. Depending on the student's story and where they're at on that given day, they might just need that, you know, quick 10 minutes or that period of time just to take a breath and then get themselves collected and head back to class.
So you're talking about a real positive opportunity for students. It comes, though, from concerns about mental health in students in your area. Talk about that.
Right. So last year we had over like 1,500 counselor visits. Our hospitalization increased by 15%. So again, going back to the stories, we have 1,600 different stories and each are walking in with unique backgrounds. And we're trying to create safe places where they can get some attentiveness of calm and just a chance to get themselves back where they need to be.
Right. Because we understand that, that there may be, you know, more than 1,000 visits to counselors that might be for college or for mental health concerns, anywhere in between. But enrollment is just 1,500 students. Why does that trigger an alarm for you?
Well, it's not necessarily an alarm. It's just making sure that we have a space and some resources that will assist students with whatever their needs might be.
Okay. And how does that fit into the broader kind of mindset that we're taking now in trying to meet students where they are at these different stages in these different classrooms and really tailor learning and the experience to them?
Right. Again, you know, as we are, you know, looking at forward for high schools and education period, if they're not in a space or in a place where they aren't safe or they feel comfortable, it becomes very difficult to get to the learning phase. And so if we don't have them in that arena, then it becomes extremely hard and it becomes more of a challenge and roadblock when you actually get into the classroom and start, you know, trying to work through the learning itself. So if we can tailor different options like this to provide that, you know, soft landing as well as a spot to just check where they're at, this gives the learning even more of a chance to happen.
And in our last moments together, how are you going to measure the success of this Zenden?
Right. So each time a student comes down, we do have a check-in system, and we'll use that data and look back at, you know, how many students are actually visiting on a regular to, you know, if you see reoccurrence or patterns of certain students that we can best help them, maybe even a little bit more than beyond the Zenden itself.
Matt, thank you.
Keely, thank you.
That's Matt Mino, principal of Appleton East High School, talking about a new dedicated space at his school for students to focus on improving their mental health.
Coming up, we'll talk to two state lawmakers about the challenges facing Wisconsin's farmers and where they think the state can do more to help. I'm Rob Ferrett.
And I'm Keely Boltina. You're listening to Central Time right here on the Ideas Network.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett.
And I'm Keely Boltina. Coming up tomorrow at 6 on The Morning Show, some Wisconsin farmers have started growing hemp after state and national laws opened the door for the crop. Kate Archer-Kent and her guest look at the challenges and the opportunities facing farmers in the hemp market. That's tomorrow morning at 6 right here on the Ideas Network.
Now, the state's farmers have had a lot of challenges in the last few years, ranging from low commodity prices to trade tariffs and wet weather. And while the agricultural economy as a whole has grown, thanks in large part to food processing, almost 700 dairy farms closed in the state last year alone.
Milk prices have gone up a bit compared to last year at this time, and some economists are predicting that 2020 will be a year of strong prices. But farmers may choose to pay off debt before they invest in more production.
Two members of Wisconsin's State Assembly Committee on Agriculture join us now. Travis Tranel is a Republican representing the 49th Assembly District, including Cuba City. Representative Tranel, thanks a lot for joining us.
My pleasure. Thanks for asking me to be on.
And Don Vruwink is a Democrat representing the state's 43rd Assembly District. That includes Edgerton and Whitewater. He's here with us in the studio. Representative Vruwink, thanks for coming up.
Thank you for having me, and I'm glad you have Representative Tranel working here.
A bipartisan look at agriculture. Let's start with you, Representative Vruwink. What do you hear when you talk to farmers in your district and around the state as the biggest concerns they're seeing?
Well, the farmers in my district, the biggest concern is probably the trade war that's going on. In my district, I don't have very many dairy farmers anymore because Rock County, where a lot of my farmers exist, are bigger farmers who have 1,000 or more acres, and they've gotten out of the dairy business. So their concern is the soybean corn prices.
I'm Representative Tranel. You're a dairy farmer yourself. What do you see as some of the challenges facing farmers that the state could have a role in helping out with?
Well, that's a loaded question, primarily because of the second half. So much of our ag policy in this country is obviously federal, so it becomes really challenging in terms of what can an individual state do to help out. But from my perspective, the farmers I talk to, everyone's number one concern is prices, and then secondly, The weather has just been unbelievably challenged in the last 13, 14 months.
Representative Channel, you were one of the authors of a bill to establish a dairy innovation hub, and that'll operate through three UW system campuses, Madison, Platteville, and River Falls. That funding was approved. What kind of things are going to be happening with this innovation hub?
Well, it's no secret, you know, all of agriculture has been in a downturn for at least the last five years. Dairy's been hit particularly hard. I think oftentimes, you know, people are so far removed from the farm now. We have less than 2% of us that are actually feeding the other 98%. We kind of forget how big agriculture as a whole is to the state of Wisconsin. We just crossed $100 billion economic impact, and half of that is dairy in and of itself. So the dairy sector in the state of Wisconsin makes up 15% of our overall economy, which is just astronomical. So the idea behind the Dairy Innovation Hub was to, one, recognize that dairy is in a tough spot right now, but also to show that we as state leaders, myself, Representative Ruwink, other people in the Ag Committee, we fully understand how important agriculture is, not just to rural Wisconsin, but to our state's economy overall. So we want to collaborate with UW to make sure that we are on the forefront when it comes to researching ways to utilize milk, maybe alternative ways to use milk that we're not currently doing, making sure that we're offering new products that are exciting, that consumers want, et cetera. So the Dairy Innovation Hub is a small commitment, but it's definitely more than that in terms of showing our agricultural sector in the state that we realize just how important and how pivotal their success is tied to our success.
Representative Ruwink, another legislative measure you and Representative Channel, I understand, are working on, a small farm diversity grant program. What is that?
Well, that was a bill I introduced that I was thankful Representative Channel signed on, but it's where 50 acres or less can get a $50,000 grant if they match the $50,000 to do something that's out of the ordinary in agriculture, like maybe start a farm-to-table operation, which I have a number of them in my district. In fact, I highlighted one with a Ben Stair, who lives in Plymouth Township, who has organic vegetable farm. And then he has people actually come out of Chicago, drive 3 hours to his farm. He hires a chef to make these products, and they come and they partake in this. And these are things that I think are important to keep agricultural in the forefront in Wisconsin, is that we allow people who like agriculture, who don't have the money to get into large scale, can start a small scale operation and expand their enterprises later on.
Talking to State Assembly Representatives Don Ruwink and Travis Tranel, they're both on the Assembly's Agricultural Committee, looking at some issues facing farmers in the state and some efforts in the state legislature on related issues. We hear a lot, Representative Tranel, from our callers we made today, that the problem is the larger farms that Representative Ruwink was talking about earlier, consolidation, driving smaller operations out of business. Is that a concern you share?
Well, it's certainly a concern, but I mean, we could talk for hours about even the way you phrased that question. The way that you phrased it, I would agree that probably 90% of the population would have phrased it in the same way, but it's so much more complicated than that, Matt, because the consolidation of farming is primarily happening because of prices. It's so competitive and the margins are so thin that you're forced to either get bigger or to get out, because you have to have that economy of scale to have any chance at all at making a profit. So the very people that say that they don't necessarily like that consolidation are also the very people that are benefiting from the cheapest food anywhere in the industrialized world. So and I'm sorry, I apologize for that. I'm actually on the farm, so that's a tractor in the background.
But that's fine.
So the consolidation factor is, it's a concern and a challenge just as much for those of us who are actually in agriculture as it is for those that aren't. But the people that are benefiting the most from that consolidation are the 98% of the people that don't have to worry about who grows their food. And I guess as a public policy maker, and I think Representative Ruwink would agree with me, sometimes that's what becomes so challenging, because the general public just sometimes they fail to see that. They don't understand that they are the direct recipient and the beneficiary of the efficiencies that we have in modern production agriculture.
Well, let me ask both of you a fundamental question. I'll start with you, Representative Ruink. Is there a benefit to having small farms stay in existence in Wisconsin?
I think there's a place for all size, small, medium, and large. But as Representative Trinell said, you know, the larger farms present a greater economy of scale, and it allows farmers, like large farms, sometimes you have three and four brothers go together to farm, and they each become an expert in one area, and so that seems to be the trend going. But I heard when I was on the Governor Walker's Dairy Task Force he assigned that the people there still wanted a place for small, medium, and large. They just didn't, because they were small, they just didn't want to be dropped by, you know, someone like a producer because they were too small. And so I think if we look at it that way, I think we have to guarantee success, that everybody is treated equally, no matter their size. But I think, as Representative Trinell said, you know, economy of scale helps produce food cheaper.
So is it worth it, Representative Trinell, to try to keep those small operations around, given that they don't have that economy of scale?
110%. It's absolutely worth it. And that's where it becomes a challenge, because those larger producers who have the benefits of economy of scale, they're able to produce food cheaper than those smaller operations. But in terms of economic impact to our rural communities, that's where we absolutely need to do what Representative Ruink said and make sure that we have a climate in place, an agriculture policy in place that allows all sizes of farms to thrive. And in my opinion, that's what we're failing to do right now. And frankly, what we've been failing to do probably for the last 50 years. And it's not state agricultural policy that's encouraging that, but federal policy.
Is that, do you think, Representative Trinell, part of the job of state lawmakers and other officials to try to bring that argument to the federal policymakers?
You know, I've had my job now. I've been in the Wisconsin legislature for 10 years, and I'm beginning to believe more and more that a primary responsibility of our job is to just hold up our hand and say, hey, this doesn't make any sense. You guys need to pay attention to this. So I absolutely believe that's within our power, and I believe that we have a responsibility to do that. You know, I represent a rural area, and if we don't have these small, medium, and mid-sized farms, and some of the larger ones for that matter, our future doesn't look as bright as what it should be. You know, it affects the number of students that go to our public schools. It affects the number of people that shop on our main streets. It affects the number of people that go to church on Sunday. I mean, these are far-reaching policy discussions that we need to have, and it affects not only the state of Wisconsin, but it affects all of rural America.
Representative Ruink, are there things you would like to see from federal policy here?
Well, I would like to see actually less federalism. I would like to see states not send quite so much money to the national government and make our own policies, because all the states are so unique in a sense. We're kind of hamstrung because we get grants from the federal government, but then with those grants come federal regulations that sometimes don't make sense in our rural communities here in Wisconsin. So I agree with Representative Trinell that I wish we as a state could do more to help our own individual farmers rather than depend so much upon the federal government for so much.
We're talking to Republican State Representative Travis Trinell and Democratic State Representative Don Ruink about agricultural issues here in Wisconsin.
And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Do you think the state should work to ensure small dairy farms stay around, or should it take a more hands-off approach? Do you work in farming or food production? Maybe you work in another side of the ag industry. What action from the state do you want to see? And what questions do you have for our guests? 800-642-1234 is the number to call, or you can post on the Ideas Network Facebook page.
We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett.
And I'm Keely Boltina. We're continuing our talk with two state representatives from the State Assembly's Agriculture Committee, Representative Travis Trinell and Democrat Don Ruink.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you're a farmer yourself, you work in a related field, pardon the pun, is there action you think the state should be taking to make conditions better? Are you worried about the balance of small and large farms in the state? Should the state government take a role in striking that balance, or should it get out of the way? If you have questions for our guests about their priorities on the Agriculture Committee, call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll bring on a caller now. Rich is with us in Green Bay. Rich, hi.
Hi. I would just like them to discuss the issue of federal subsidies. Years ago, the federal subsidies went to help small farmers, and it tied them to the tough times. Nowadays, it's the wealthy, large corporate farmers that get the federal subsidies, you know, to the tune of billions of dollars, and those are the farmers that got the breaks to help them through the tariffs. The small farms no longer get the support that they used to, and that's why they're struggling. And they can feed the world, but they just need the support that they used to get. I'd like them to discuss the issue of those subsidies.
Rich, thanks for the call. Representative Tranley, your thoughts on subsidies and who they go to?
Certainly. So first off, the small farms get on a per acre basis or a per pound basis, they get subsidized just as much as the large farms. In actuality, the most recent farm bill that got passed was actually skewed. So dairy producers that had a production history of producing 5 million pounds or less on their dairy farms, which is about 100 cows, actually got more money than the large farm. So that component is not necessarily true, but the heart of the question, I would agree that our federal subsidy policy needs to be looked at. And so here's why I think it's a complicated issue. So I mentioned earlier that food in this country is cheaper than anywhere else in the industrialized world, and your listeners are welcome to Google that. Some developed countries like Japan, they pay 15-20% of their take-home pay in food. So if we're not going to subsidize our farmers, they have to be able to pay their bills somehow, because no business can continue to operate at a loss forever. So I think sometimes the general public, they hear, well, farmers are getting subsidies, that's because they can't make any money. Well, that's true, but that's because our food is so cheap, so that the 98% of the people that are actually buying it can afford to buy it. So I think you can make a pretty strong argument that it's the 98% that are getting subsidized and not the farmers themselves. But in terms of looking at making sure that our federal ag policy supports and makes sure that there's a place for small and medium-sized farms, I would totally agree with your caller and say that we need to do a better job of doing that as a government.
Representative Ruink, your thoughts on that balance?
Well, I agree a lot with what Representative Tranel said. And the problem with making policy at the federal level is that the agriculture states have the least representation. So you have to get the states with the large base population, which are New York's and California's and Texas, to agree to any changes. And that sometimes is difficult, so you got to get trade-offs. Well, things move slow today because of the division in our federal government, and I agree that we need to do a better job of looking at our federal policy every couple years to meet what's happening in the farm world, what's going on. And now, because we're losing money, the farmers need to be subsidized. Otherwise, they go out of business.
Thanks for that call. Go to Doug now in Mauston. Doug, hi.
Hello. I just wanted to comment and say I appreciate that these two gentlemen from opposing parties can work together to better our rural communities. I live in Mauston, and we have a lot of ag in our area, and I've seen the declines over the last 20 years. My family's live on my initial family homestead and farm, and my uncle shut down, and nobody else is farming around here when these things closed down. And I just wanted to say I appreciate hearing two representatives from opposing parties working together to try and make our communities better.
Doug, thanks a lot for the call. Representative Ruink, following up on that, you mentioned earlier, you know, at the national level, you've got maybe farm states and non-farming states, the populous states. Do you see a similar thing going on here in Wisconsin where rural lawmakers from both parties, like you two, can work together on a thing, but maybe you're not always feeling heard?
Well, I agree. Representative Tranel and I agree on a lot of things, and we both like common sense policies. And we both see the rural areas suffering because we're losing population, and the rural areas are getting older. And so we have to make changes to represent the demographics of our state. And my concern is with the schools. You know, we have schools in all the rural areas, and the majority of our schools are rural schools. with declining enrollment. 70% of our schools have declining enrollment, which brings challenges. So we need to keep population in the rural areas because we have the infrastructure in place. So we have to do things to entice people to stay in those areas.
Thanks for that call, Representative Tranel. Thoughts on what Representative Brewink is saying on how you can do that, how you can entice people to move to rural Wisconsin?
And you know, there's so much to offer in rural Wisconsin, and I think, we see that more and more. People graduate from college and they want to move away because they don't want anything to do with their hometown. But 5 or 6, 7 years later, after they're married and they start having a few kids, they start to realize, you know, there's more to life than just making money. You know, rural Wisconsin, we know who our neighbors are. We care about each other. You know, I live on a very rural road. If a car drives by that I don't recognize, you know, we talk about that at church, so to speak. there's definitely benefits of living in rural Wisconsin. And it's not just for those of us that live here. It's for society as a whole. I mean, how often have you heard, you know, a job opening and they'll hire any farm kid that they can find because they know they have the background and the work ethic and the expertise. And quite frankly, I think that's where we need to do a better job, both myself and people that live in rural Wisconsin. When we talk to our colleagues who are from more urban and suburban areas, we have to explain to them why it's not only important to invest in rural Wisconsin because we love where we live, but we need to do a better job of communicating why it's important for them to have a strong rural Wisconsin and a rural America as well. And quite frankly, that's something I think we struggle with because I'm not really sure we've looked at it all that in-depthly. And it's something that I hope we can study more moving forward in the future because I'm a big believer that the rural parts of this country have a phenomenal role to play in the future moving forward. If you look at our past, they define what America was and how it became what it is. But we need to do a better job of making sure people that have, for whatever reason, decided to live in more urban and consolidated areas understand the importance of keeping these rural areas vibrant and healthy. You know, real quickly, it's kind of funny. You talked about the consolidation of farms earlier, and is that a good thing or a bad thing? Well, our population is consolidating as well. People are moving to more urban areas, moving to cities, and you know, I wonder, is that a good thing?
Representative Brewing, just our last few minutes, follow up on what Representative Channel had to say about the value of rural Wisconsin.
Well, I grew up in rural Wisconsin in Auburndale, Wisconsin, so I understand. I grew up on a farm. I still have cousins who are farmers, and the values that rural Wisconsin teaches you are so valuable. It's made a big difference in my life, and so we need to do things to keep people in rural areas that they want to stay there. And that's where we need to focus on getting broadband to those areas so that people can work out of their homes. They can do telemedicine. They can do a number of things that they want in the urban areas. We can bring that to rural Wisconsin if we make that choice. So we need to make that choice to keep rural Wisconsin vibrant.
Representative Ruing, thanks a lot for joining us today.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
And Representative Tranel, thanks for being with us.
Hey, my pleasure. Now I can get back to farming.
All right. We've been talking to Democratic State Representative Don Ruink and Republican Representative Travis Tranel. They both sit on the State Assembly's Agriculture Committee. They join us for a look at Wisconsin's farm economy and where the state is getting involved. You can keep sharing your thoughts over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Let us know what you think about some of the issues that came up today.
And coming up tomorrow on Central Time, Congress gets a bad rap from the public, and our guest has some ideas to jazz things up, including making it less boring for the public to watch.
Police body cameras have gotten more and more popular in recent years, but do they make people safer or change the behavior of police or the public? We'll check out a new study in Milwaukee that tries to answer some of those questions.
And we'll get details on a proposed state law that would make it illegal to smoke e-cigarettes in any place where cigarettes are already banned.
All that, and we'll take a look at some of the top news stories of the day and hold out till Wednesday for a new episode of our podcast, Derailed, on the rise and fall of high-speed rail in Wisconsin. That and more tomorrow on Central Time. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's The Morning Show with Kate Archer Kent. Tomorrow at 7, as the 2020 election season gets closer, a lot of people have concerns about election security and the reliability of voting systems. Kate gets two perspectives on the issue. That's tomorrow at 7 on The Morning Show.
And coming up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. And then we talk to an investigative reporter about the people and the businesses who made big money from the housing crisis. I'm Keely Boltina.
And I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time.